Yesterday, you implied the former cadet was in danger.
She might be.
But you don't know for sure.
She pawned the ring, or sold it, or had it stolen, any of which would suggest some kind of misfortune. I think we should find out.
We?
She's one of ours, General. The guy said,
I read your file. You did well. Not well enough to get a statue on campus, which you wouldn't get anyway, mostly because of the corners you cut.
No excuse, sir, Reacher said, purely out of habit.
I have one obvious question. What are you doing now?
Nothing.
What does that mean?
It's a long story, General. We shouldn't take the time.
Major, I'm sure you understand that supplying personal details about current or former military personnel is strictly prohibited about 19 different ways. The only possible chance it could happen would be a top-secret, off-the-record whisper from one West Pointer to another, purely as a courtesy. Exactly the kind of oak-paneled bullshit we're always being accused of. Therefore, naturally, you and I face a question of mutual trust, possibly less important to you than to me. You could put my mind at rest by letting me take your measure.
Reacher was quiet a beat. I get uneasy, he said. I can't stay in one place. I'm sure if you gave the VA enough time, they could come up with a name for it. Maybe I could get a check from the government.
It's a medical condition?
Some would say.
Does it bother you?
Turns out I don't want to stay in one place anyway.
How frequently do you move around?
Constantly.
Do you think that's a fitting way for a West Pointer to live?
I think it's perfectly fitting.
In what sense?
We fought for freedom. This is what freedom looks like. The guy said,
there are 100 reasons for selling a ring, or pawning it, or losing it, or getting it stolen somehow. Not all the reasons are bad. This could be completely innocent.
Could be. That's a little lukewarm, General. Sounds like you don't know for sure, even after reading her file, which therefore can't have reassured you completely, so now you're hinting about a whisper, because now you're worried. I think deep down you want to tell me her name, so let me guess. She took off the green suit, and now she's under the radar.
3 years ago.
After what?
5 hard tours in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Doing what?
Unpleasant things, I imagine.
Is she small?
Like a bird.
That's her, Reacher said. Now it's decision time, General.
What are you going to do?
The soup didn't answer. Out the window, Reacher saw a black sedan slow up. It stopped on the curb across the street, outside the laundromat. The driver's door opened. The guy climbed out. He was tall and bony, maybe 50 years old. He had gray hair cut short. He was wearing a black suit with a white shirt buttoned to the neck, but without a tie. He stood on the sidewalk for a second and looked a question at the sentry at the door, who shook his head as if to say, "No trouble, boss." Arthur Scorpio, who nodded back at the sentry and then stepped past him in through the door. The sentry stepped across the sidewalk in the other direction and got in Scorpio's car. He drove it away, to park it, presumably, on a side street or in the alley. Maybe a 5-minute absence. The first of 2 such absences, presumably. He would go retrieve the car at close of business. 2 5-minute windows, every day. Good to know. In Reacher's ear, the West Point soup said,
"She might not want to be found. Did you consider that? No one comes back whole. Not
from 5 tours. I'm not trying to sell her a timeshare in Mexico. If she looks okay from a distance, I'll walk away and leave her alone.
How will you even find her? She's under the radar. Will her name even help?
It won't hurt, Reacher said, especially not at the end. I'll follow the ring until I find someone who heard of her. The soup said,
her name is Serena Rose Sanderson.
Chapter 9. Out the window, the front sentry walked back into view after parking Scorpio's car. He resumed his position, leaning on the wall to the left of the laundromat door, arms folded, impassive. He had been gone just over 5 minutes. Still no customers inside. Into the phone, Reacher said, where is Serena Rose Sanderson from?
As a cadet, her home state was listed as Wyoming, the soup said. That's all we've got. You think she went back there?
Depends, Reacher said. For some people, home is the first place they go. For others, it's the last. What was she like?
She was before my time, the soup said. But her file is very solid. She was pretty close to outstanding, without ever quite getting there. Never in the top 5, always in the top 10.
That kind of person?
She branched infantry, which was considered a smart choice for a woman back in 05. She knew she wouldn't see combat, but she guessed the chaos would push her pretty damn near to it, which I'm sure is what happened. Close support units were always busy. A lot of driving for resupply, which meant a lot of roadside IEDs, plus vehicle recovery, which would have exposed her out in the open. Off-post, she would have been armed at all times. I'm sure she was in firefights. Those units took plenty of casualties, same as anyone else. She has a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart, so she was wounded herself at some point.
Rank?
Terminal at Major, the guy said.
Like you.
On her last tour, she was doing a pretty big job. She led her soldiers well. On paper, she's a credit to the school.
Okay, Reacher said.
Thank you, General.
So proceed, but with caution.
Don't worry.
I do.
Why?
I read your file, the guy said again.
If you tilt it right and hold it in a sunbeam, you can see the invisible writing. You were effective, but reckless.
Was I?
You know you were. You got away with things time after time.
Did I?
One damn thing after another, but you always came up smelling of roses.
Then draw the appropriate conclusion, General. I wasn't reckless. I was relying on methods I knew had worked before and would likely work again.
I felt I was the opposite of reckless. There's a clue in the word. Wreck comes from reckon. And I felt I did more reckoning than most folks, not less.
Call me back, the guy said.
Let me know about Sanderson.
For the second day running, Gloria Nakamura was early to work. She parked her car and walked up the stairs. The mother hen at the gate to the detective's pen told her the lieutenant wanted to see her. First thing. Urgent, but not critical. The mother hen said his voice on the phone had sounded okay, not particularly angry. Nakamura dropped her bag at her desk and headed off down the corridor. The lieutenant's office was a corner suite at the far end of the floor. He was a cancer survivor, worn down to nothing but lacy bone and sinew, but lit up through his papery skin by some kind of crazed internal energy. He had gotten some bonus years, and he was going to slap the shit out of him. He was going to get big things done. Privately, Nakamura felt his brush with death had produced an epiphany. He was afraid of being forgotten. He was at his desk reading email. He said, "You sent me a thing about Arthur Scorpio." She said,
"A voicemail from Wisconsin." "Yes, boss, there have been developments."
"Has Bigfoot arrived?"
"Yes, boss, I believe he has, but first there was a private eye from Chicago."
"What did he want?"
"He wouldn't say, but I checked him out. He's a missing persons specialist. Very expensive."
"Who's missing?"
"About 1 million people, nationwide."
"Any reason to believe one of them is washing his shorts in Scorpio's place?"
"There's nothing on the wires."
"Tell me about Bigfoot."
"He's a military veteran named Reacher. He found a West Point class ring in a pawn shop, and he's tracing its provenance."
"Like a hobby?"
"No, like a matter of military honor, like a moral obligation, verging on the sentimental, in my opinion."
"How is Scorpio involved?"
"The likelihood is the ring was stolen property fenced by Scorpio to a Wisconsin biker named Jimmy Ratt, who then sold it onward to the pawn shop where Bigfoot found it. Bigfoot says the pawn shop owner told him Jimmy Ratt's name, who told him Arthur Scorpio's name. Now he wants Scorpio to name the next name, whoever he got the ring from, and so on all the way down the line. Bigfoot wants to return the ring to its rightful owner. That's my assessment."
"Scorpio won't tell him shit."
"I think he might. I'm not sure Bigfoot was telling the whole truth about what happened in Wisconsin. I don't think a biker with a lucrative trade in stolen property would tell anyone anything, least of all the name of a supplier, not voluntarily. You should listen to the audio. Jimmy Ratt sounds scared."
"Of Bigfoot?"
"I saw him, boss. You could put him in a zoo."
"You think Scorpio will be scared, too?"
"Either way, I think a serious crime is about to be committed. Either Bigfoot will squeeze too hard, or Scorpio will push back too hard." Then she waited.
The lieutenant said, "I think we should get the surveillance going again."
She said, "Yes, boss," and breathed out.
"Just you. Eyes on at all times. Nothing subtle. Get right up in his grill."
"I might need backup. I might need to intervene."
"No," the guy said. "Don't intervene. Let nature take its course. It's a win-win. If Scorpio hurts the guy, that's great, because then we've got something on him at last. We've got you as an actual eyewitness to a felony assault. On the other hand, if the guy hurts Scorpio, that's good news anyway. The worse, the better. Plus, you could always arrest the guy afterward, if you wanted to, for a felony assault of his own. If you need to boost your quarterly numbers, I mean."
Reacher left the breakfast place through the kitchen door and slipped away through the alley. He didn't want the front sentry to see him. Not yet. The Bigfoot description would leave the guy in no doubt. Word would pass instantly to Scorpio inside. Better not to get them too excited too soon. So he skirted around at a safe radius and then headed downtown and started looking for better hotels than his own, the kind of place a retired FBI gumshoe might choose. No flea pits, but nothing fancy either. Probably a mid-market national chain. The guy probably had a loyalty card. Reacher found four possibilities. At the first, he went in and asked the clerk for a guest named Terence Bramall, small guy, neat, in a suit and tie. If he was in a car, it might have Illinois plates. The woman pattered at her keyboard and stared at her screen, and then she said she was sorry, but currently the hotel had no guests with that name. At the second possibility,
Reacher was told Terence Bramwell had checked out just 30 minutes before. Or maybe even less, the clerk said. Maybe only 20. She called up the closed account to calibrate her memory. It was 27 minutes ago. The guy had stopped at the desk in his suit and tie with a leather traveling bag in one hand and a leather briefcase in the other. He paid his bill and headed out to his car, which was in the covered lot. It was a black SUV with Illinois plates. Bramall loaded his bags and then got in and drove off toward the interstate, but whether he then turned east or west was anyone's guess. "You have his cell phone number?" Reacher asked. The woman glanced at her screen. Left-hand column, Reacher thought. Maybe two-thirds of the way up. The woman said,
"I really can't give it out."
Reacher pointed at the base of the wall behind her.
"Is that a cockroach?"
he said. Not a word hotel keepers liked to hear. She turned to look. He leaned over the desk and bent his neck, left-hand column two-thirds of the way up, 10 digits. Not a prodigious feat of memory. He straightened up. She turned back.
"I didn't see anything," she said.
"False alarm," Reacher said. "Sorry. Maybe just a shadow."
Reacher found a payphone in the lobby of an all-day Chinese restaurant. It was a chromium instrument mounted on a wall of red velvet. Not as glamorous as it looked from a distance. The chrome was pitted, and the velvet was threadbare and tacky with grease. Reacher dialed Bramall's cell number. It rang and rang. It wasn't picked up. No big surprise, the guy was probably on the interstate. Probably a safety-first type of person, probably had to be, to survive a lifetime in the FBI. No answer. A recorded voice came on, inviting Reacher to leave a message. He said, "Mr. Bramall, my name is Reacher. We waited in line together last night for sandwiches, and we were briefly in the breakfast place at the same time this morning. I infer you were watching Arthur Scorpio's place in connection with a missing persons inquiry. I was watching it in connection with trying to trace the source of a piece of stolen property. I think we should put our heads together to figure out exactly what we both know, just in case there's more here than meets the eye. Could be useful for one of us, if not both. You can't call me back because I don't have a phone, so I'll try you again at a later time. Thank you. Goodbye." He hung up. He stepped out from the velvet lobby to the concrete sidewalk. Arthur Scorpio's black sedan stopped at the curb, right next to him, level with his hip. The window buzzed down. The front door sentry said,
"Get in the car."
Chapter 10. The guy had a gun, a revolver. It looked like a worn-out chief's special, a .38 5-shooter by Smith & Wesson, short barrel. It looked small in the guy's hand, his right hand. He was half-twisted behind the wheel, aiming half-sideways through the open passenger window with a bent arm and a cramped right shoulder.
"In the car," he said again.
Reacher stood still. He had choices. Life was full of them. Easiest thing would be just walk away, straight ahead along the sidewalk in the same direction the car had been driving. A right-handed shooter in a left-hand drive car would have a practical problem with that kind of geometry. His windshield was in the way. Couldn't shoot through it. The bullet would deflect and miss, and afterward there would be a hole in the windshield. Not a smart thing to have. Rapid City was no doubt a tough old town, but it wasn't South Central L.A. Morning gunfire would get called in, especially downtown, near the hotels and the restaurants. Police cruisers would show up fast. Questions about a bullet hole in a windshield would be hard to answer. So the guy would have to move. He would have to shift the transmission and take his foot off the brake and shrug off his seatbelt and flip up the armrests and shuffle his ass across the front bench and hang his right arm out the passenger window, all of which would take a small but finite amount of time, during which Reacher would be walking farther and farther away. And all the guy had was a worn-out .38 with a 2.5-inch barrel. Not an accurate weapon. More or less a guaranteed miss with the speed Reacher could walk. So the better bet would be hang out the driver's window. Much quicker. It was right there. But how? The guy would have to kneel up sideways on the driver's seat and stick his whole upper body out and wriggle his right arm free like putting on a tight sweater, bringing him all the way out of the car up to his waist, and then he would have to twist and aim and fire. Except, at that point, he would also be overbalancing and about to fall out the window. An inaccurate weapon and a preoccupied shooter clinging to the door mirror. Not a whole lot to worry about. Which meant the guy's best bet would be step out and brace behind the open door, like a cop. Except, as soon as Reacher heard the creak of the hinge, he would duck out of sight into the nearest store or alley. Same thing if he heard the car move off the curb and roll toward him. Stalemate. The whole get-in-the-car thing looked pretty good in the movies, but on the street it was basically optional. Plenty of choices. Keep calm and walk away. Live to fight another day. But Reacher stayed where he was. He said, "You want me to get in the car?" The guy said, "Right now." "Then put the gun away." Or I won't get in the car."
"I could shoot you first and get you in bleeding."
"No," Reacher said, "you really couldn't." All he had to do was take one fast pace left. Then the guy would be shooting through glass again, or the B pillar or the C pillar, plus any way his shoulder was tight against the upholstery and wouldn't rotate. Plus again, the cops would come. Lights and sirens, questions. The guy was stuck. He was an amateur, which was encouraging. "Put the gun away," Reacher said again.
"How do I know you'll get in?"
"I'm happy to visit with Mr. Scarpio. He has information for me. I was planning to call on him later today, but since you're here, I guess this is as good a time as any."
"How do you know I'm working for Scarpio?"
"Magic," Reacher said. The guy held still for a second, and then he put the gun back in his coat pocket. Reacher opened the passenger door. The sedan was an ancient Lincoln town car, the old square style, the kind that got crashed and burned on the TV shows because they were cheaper than dirt. The upholstery was red velvet, no better or worse than the restaurant lobby's walls, a little crushed and greasy. Reacher crammed himself in the seat. He put his elbow on the armrest. His left hand hung loose, the size of a dinner plate. The guy stared at it for a second. Long, thick fingers with knuckles like walnuts, old nicks and scars healed white. The guy looked away. No longer top dog. Uncharted territory for a man who made his living leaning on walls and scaring people. "Drive," Reacher said. "I haven't got all day." They took off, left and right through the downtown blocks, back to the low-rent district. They parked outside the laundromat. The guy took out his gun again, saving face in front of Scorpio. Reacher let him. Why not? It cost him nothing. He waited until the guy came around and opened his door. And then he got out, and the guy nodded toward the laundromat entrance. Reacher went in first, to the smell of drains and cold soap, and the back door sentry leaning on a washing machine, and Arthur Scorpio himself, sitting in a plastic lawn chair, as if he was a customer, hypnotized by the churning drums. Up close, he had pitted skin on his face, unnaturally white as if it had been treated with chemicals. The pallor made his eyes look dark. He was tall and thin, maybe 6 feet 2, maybe 160 pounds, but only if he had a dollar's worth of pennies in his pocket, all skin and bone, and awkward as a stepladder. The back door sentry pushed himself off the washing machine and came over to stand close. The guy who had driven the car stepped up from behind. Scorpio said,
"What do you want?"
"You fenced a ring to Jimmy Rat," Reacher said. "I want to know who fenced it to you."
"Oh, you got the wrong person altogether.
I run a laundromat. I don't know any Jimmy Rat."
"Is the laundromat doing well?"
"I'm comfortable." "And modest. You're doing better than comfortable. Your cash flow is so big you had to hire 2 guys to watch over it. Except, I don't see how. You got no customers."
"You are accusing me of something?"
Out the window, a pale blue car stopped on the opposite curb. A domestic product. A Chevrolet, possibly. Nothing fancy, a plain specification. In it was a small Asian woman. Black hair, dark eyes, a severe expression. Nakamura. She just sat there, engine off, head turned, watching. A level gaze over the hood of Scorpio's parked Lincoln. Her eyes were locked on Reacher's, through 2 layers of glass and 30 feet of air. Reacher turned back to Scorpio and said, "Jimmy Rat left you a voicemail, which is why you hired these guys. He told you I was coming, and here I am. It's up to you how long I stay." Scorpio said,
"Firstly, I don't know what you're talking about, and secondly, you know who that is, in the blue car across the street?"
"She's a cop, Detective Nakamura,
who harasses me on a regular basis, as you can see, for completely invented reasons. But this time she can make herself useful for once. You're trespassing, and she can come remove you herself."
"My tax dollars at work."
"You pay taxes? You accusing me of something?"
"I'm not trespassing. You invited me here. Kind of insisted."
"My point is, you can stick your little threats where the sun don't shine. Up to me how long you stay. What are you going to do with a cop watching?"
"I know her name because we talked. She told me you're not well liked within the police department."
"Mutual."
"It's a code. In plain English, it means I could rip your arm off and beat you to death with it, and they wouldn't stop me. They'd sell tickets instead."
"What code? You a cop, too, from somewhere?"
"You expecting one?"
"Not me. I'm just a guy with a question. Tell me the answer, and I'm gone."
Scorpio said,
"You never asked how I found you."
Reacher said, "Didn't need to. I already figured it out from where your boy showed up. Restaurant staff. You slipped them a few bucks. They all talk to each other. They all have cell phones. They text. A nice little network. Underpaid and underappreciated. You put the word out, based on Jimmy Rat's voicemail. Watch out for Bigfoot to come out of the forest. That's what Jimmy said, right?"
"I don't know any Jimmy, which is my point. I'm going to sit here and deny it all day long.
Nothing you can do about it with a cop watching.
Maybe she'll leave.
She won't. She sits there all day. We'll be gone before she is. Then, what are you going to do?
Run after us?
Which is my other point. Good luck with your night in town. You won't get a meal anywhere. You won't get a drink. You won't get a bed. I got more than one network running.
I'm sure you're a regular Al Capone, Reacher said. Except you got the worst piece-of-shit car in the world.
Get lost. You're wasting everyone's time. Nothing you can do, not with a cop watching, cold or no cold, which is bullshit anyway. This is America.
We could run a test, Reacher said. I could punch you in the mouth, and we could time how long she took to get in here.
The two sentries stepped in closer. No guns, no pushing or shoving. They couldn't. Nakamura was watching.
They put themselves one each side of Scorpio's lawn chair, a step ahead of it, overlapping it a little, closing it off. Reacher was facing them, not more than an arm's length away in a flat little triangle. He said, "Is she still watching?"
Scorpio said, "Harder than ever."
"Are you going to answer my question?"
"You got the wrong person altogether."
"Okay," Reacher said.
"I get it."
He patted the air, a placatory gesture, as if defeated, as if requesting a timeout or a reset or a reboot or whatever else might help him. He said, "What if," in a speculative way, but he didn't finish the question. Instead, he kept his hand on his brow and rubbed, as if easing a headache or searching for a word. And then he raised his other hand, too, and ran his fingers through his hair, back and forth, fast, like a mental rinse. And then he moved his hands down and put his fingers flat over his mouth, almost steepled, over pursed lips, a meditative gesture. And then he rubbed his eyes, and then he pressed his fingers hard on his temples, like a person just one thought away from a solution. All of which got his hands up at eye level, with no one suspecting a thing. He flicked his right hand out and back real fast, a blur like a snake's tongue, his fingers closing into a fist as it went, and he hit the right-hand guy in the face. Not much force behind it, a busted nose, maybe nothing more. But nothing more was required. The idea was to freeze the guy for a split second, that was all, while the same right hand on its way back pivoted into a full-blown right hook with a violent twist at the waist and the shoulders, which hit the left-hand guy smack in the throat. Better than the face. No bones. The left-hand guy went down like a slammed door. Meanwhile, Reacher was unwinding the twist and turning it into an equal and opposite left hook, and hitting the right-hand guy also in the throat. Perfectly symmetrical. Less than 3 seconds, beginning to end. Plus, style points. The right-hand guy went down late and slowly, like a street light in an auto wreck. Reacher heard the slap of linoleum and the thump of bone. He stood there like nothing had happened. He said, "Just you and me now." Scorpio said nothing. Reacher said, "Is the cap getting out of her car?" Scorpio didn't answer. Reacher ducked down left and right and took guns out of pockets. Both the same, Smith & Wesson Chief's specials, both looking older than he was. He put them in his own pockets. He said, "Is she out of her car yet?" Scorpio said,
"No." "Is she on the phone?" "No."
"The radio?"
"No."
"So what's she doing?"
"Just watching."
"Remember what I said about running a test?" Scorpio didn't answer. Nakamura saw the sentries close ranks in front of Scorpio, who was leaning back in his lawn chair like some kind of emperor on a throne. Reacher was facing the three of them, up close, an arm's length away. There was some verbal back and forth. Two questions, two answers, short sentences, brief and to the point. Then Reacher scratched his head. Then he seemed to have some kind of violent physical spasm, and for no apparent reason the sentries fell over. He had hit them. She scrabbled for her door release. She stopped.
That's good news, anyway.
Don't intervene. She took a deep breath and watched. Reacher sat down in the lawn chair next to Scorpio's. He stretched out and got comfortable and stared straight ahead at an inert Maytag. Scorpio was silent beside him. They looked like two old men at a ball game. The sentries stayed on the floor, breathing, but not easily. Reacher took the West Point ring from his pocket. He balanced it on his palm. He said, "I need to know who you got this from."
"I never saw that before," Scorpio said. "I run a laundromat."
"What have you got in your pockets?"
"Why?"
"You need to take it all out. I'm going to put you in the tumble dryer. Keys or coins might damage the mechanism." Scorpio glanced at a tumble dryer. Couldn't help himself. He said,
"I wouldn't fit."
"You would," Reacher said.
"I never saw that ring before."
"You sold it to Jimmy Rat.
Never heard of him."
"Where I set the temperature down is up to you. We'll start on delicates, then we'll turn it up. Someone told me it goes all the way to where it can kill a bedbug." Scorpio said nothing. "I understand," Reacher said. "You're Mr. Rapid City. You're the man. You got a bunch of networks running. Which is your problem? Maybe they're all interconnected, in which case one question might lead to another. The whole thing might unravel. You can't afford for that to happen. Hence the stone wall."
"I get it.
Perfectly understandable. Except you need to remember two very important things. Firstly,
I don't care. I'm not a cop. I don't have another question.
And secondly, I'll put you in the tumble dryer. So you're between a rock and a hard place here. You need to get creative. You ever read a book?"
"Sure."
"What kind?"
"About the moon landings."
"That's called non-fiction. There's another kind called fiction. You make stuff up, perhaps to eliminate a greater central truth. In your case, maybe you could tell me a story about a poor homeless man, maybe from out of town, who came in to launder his clothes, except he had no money, nothing at all except the ring, which you reluctantly traded for a couple of hot wash cycles and a couple of dryer loads, plus enough left over for a square meal and a bed for the night. All out of the kindness of your generous heart. Detective Nakamura couldn't argue with that. It would be a fine story."
"I would have to admit selling the ring to Jimmy Rat."
"Which was perfectly legal. You run a laundromat, you carry quarters to the bank. You don't know what to do with a ring. Fortunately, a guy passing by on his motorcycle offered to buy it from you. Not your fault he turned out to be a bad guy, you're not your brother's keeper."
"You think that's a good enough story?"
"I think it's a fine story," Reacher said again. "Just as long as you happen to remember the out-of-towner's name."
"Out of state," Scorpio said. "That's exactly what happened, more or less. Some broke guy came in from Wyoming. I helped him out."
"When?"
"6 weeks ago, maybe."
From where in Wyoming?
I believe a small town called Mule Crossing.
What was his name?
I believe it was Seymour Porterfield. I believe he told me people called him Cy.
Chapter 11. Across the street, Nakamura was still watching. Reacher stood up and stepped over the left-hand sentry. He looked at a tumble dryer, bigger than people had in their homes, good for comforters and other large items. He might have gotten Scorpio in there. He said,
"You want me to leave through the back door?"
Scorpio shook his head.
"No," he said. "Go out the front."
So Reacher stepped over the right-hand sentry and pushed out to the sidewalk. The air smelled warm and fresh. He turned right and started walking. He heard Nakamura's car start up. He heard the wheeze of its steering and grit under its tires, and then it pulled alongside him and stopped. The same as Scorpio's, except lower and bluer. The window came down. "Black hair, dark eyes, a severe expression," she said.
"Get in the car."
"You mad at me now?"
"I told you not to commit a crime inside my jurisdiction."
"We were in the laundromat. Does that even count?"
"That's not fair. We're trying."
Reacher opened the passenger door and slid inside. He wrapped the seat backward for legroom, he said.
"I apologize. I know you're trying. Scorpio is a tough nut to crack."
"What did he tell you?"
"The ring came in from a guy in Wyoming named Cy Porterfield about 6 weeks ago. Scorpio as good as admitted an onward connection to Jimmy Rat in Wisconsin. So he's part of a chain flowing west to east along the I-90 corridor."
"Can't prove it."
"Also, he pays off restaurant workers for information, which he claims is only one of many networks he's running. Maybe he's the neighborhood bookie. Maybe he lends money."
"Can't prove any of it."
"But I'm not sure how successful he is. His personal vehicle is a piece of crap worth about $100, and his goons had guns older than you."
"Did the car work?"
"I guess so."
"Would the guns have worked?"
"Probably. Revolvers are usually pretty reliable."
"This is South Dakota. People are thrifty. I think Arthur Scorpio is plenty successful."
"Okay.
Where are the guns now?"
Reacher took them out of his pockets and dropped them on her rear seat. She said,
"Thank you."
He said, "Also, there's something wrong with his back room. It would have made more sense to talk to me in there. Certainly, it would have made more sense for me to leave that way. He must have known you would stop me and ask me questions. Better if I went out through the alley. You wouldn't have seen me."
"But he wouldn't let me."
"You should check it out."
"We'd need a warrant."
"You've got the tap on his phone. He might say something stupid. A buck gets 10. He's calling Porterfield in Wyoming right now."
"Is that where you're going?"
"As soon as I find a map. The town is called Mule Crossing. I never heard of it." Nakamura took out her phone. She swiped and typed and waited, and then she said,
"It's down near Laramie, a wide spot in the road."
She held out the phone to show him. She said,
"That's the I-80 corridor, not I-90.
He said, "Population density drops to nothing west of here. A supply chain would need to branch out, literally. Maybe there are many Porterfields all over Wyoming and Montana and Idaho, all feeding Scorpio like a river system. Do you monitor his visitors?"
"We try from time to time. We've seen cars and bikes in the alley.
some with out-of-state plates. People go in and out his back door.
You need to get a look in his back room. It ain't full of drums of spare detergent, that's for damn sure. The guy has no customers.
Nakamura was quiet a beat. Then she said, "Thanks for the report." He said,
"You're welcome."
"Can I give you a ride somewhere?"
"The bus depot, I guess. I'll take whatever heads west on I-90. I'll get out in Buffalo and go south to Laramie."
"That would be the Seattle bus."
"Yes," Reacher said. "I thought it might be."
He got out of Nakamura's car at the depot and said goodbye and wished her luck. He didn't expect to see her again. He bought a ticket as far as Buffalo and sat down to wait with about 20 other people. They were the usual mixture. The room had pale, inoffensive walls and fluorescent squares in the ceiling. Out the picture window was an empty asphalt space where sooner or later the Seattle bus would show up. It was on its way from Sioux Falls. Nakamura called her friend, the tech, and asked him to check with his pal at the phone company to see who Scorpio had called in the last hour, with special focus on outgoing attempts to the 307 area code, which was Wyoming. "No need to check," the guy told her. The lieutenant had re-upped electronic surveillance, too. Everything on Scorpio's landline and personal cell was going straight to a hard drive accessible from her desktop computer. "Only one problem," the guy said. Scorpio had made no calls at all. Reacher saw South Dakota change to Wyoming through the bus window. He was in his favorite spot, on the left, over the rear axle. Most people avoided that location because they feared a bumpy ride. It was everyone else's last choice, which made it his first. He liked Wyoming for its heroic geography and its heroic climate and its emptiness. It was the size of the United Kingdom, but it had fewer people in it than Louisville, Kentucky. The Census Bureau called most of it uninhabited. What people there were tended to be straightforward and pleasant. They were happy to leave a person alone. Reacher country. The first part of the state was high plains. Fall had already started. He gazed across the immense, tawny distances to the specter of the mountains beyond. The highway was a dark, black-top ribbon, mostly empty. From time to time, trucks would pass the bus, slowly, sometimes spending a whole minute alongside, edging ahead imperceptibly. Richard was eye to eye with their drivers, across their empty cabs. Old men. All of them. "My wife would say you feel guilty about something." He looked the other way, across the aisle, at the other horizon. Nakamura walked the length of the corridor to the lieutenant's corner suite. He looked up, all glittering eyes and restlessness.
"Bigfoot left," she said. "Scorpio answered his question. Next stop? Wyoming."
"What's in Wyoming?"
"The ring was supplied to Scorpio by a man named Porterfield from a town named Mule Crossing about 6 weeks ago."
"How did Bigfoot make Scorpio tell him all that?"
"He decked the muscle. I suppose Scorpio knew he was next."
"Did you see it happen?"
"Not really," Nakamura said. "It was over very fast. I couldn't swear to exactly what took place. Not precisely enough for a courtroom."
"So, we're nowhere," the lieutenant said. "In fact, we're back a step. Scorpio's phones have gone quiet, which means he went to the pharmacy and bought a burner and some prepaid minutes, which means from now on we have no idea who or where he's calling." The lieutenant said nothing more. He returned to his email,
Nakamura walked back to her desk, quiet and alone. More than 800 miles east, in an expensive kitchen in a big Tudor house on the Gold Coast north of Chicago, a woman named Tiffany Jane McKenzie dialed Terry Bramall's cell number. It rang and rang and wasn't picked up. A recorded voice came on and asked her to leave a message. She said,
"Mr. Bramall, this is Mrs. McKenzie. I'm wondering if you've made any progress. So far, I mean. Or not, I suppose. I would like to hear either way, so please call me back as soon as you can. Thank you. Goodbye."
Then Mrs. McKenzie used her phone to check her email and her bookmarked web pages and her chat rooms and her message boards. Nothing. Richard got out of the bus at the Buffalo stop. His onward options were limited. There was no direct service to Laramie. There was a departure to nearby Cheyenne, but not until the next day. So he set out walking, following signs to the highway south, with his thumb out, hoping to get a ride before he hit the on-ramp. About 50-50, he figured. Heads or tails. In his favor was a friendly population not given to irrational fears. Against him was almost no traffic at all. The friendly population was thinly spread. Wyoming, mostly uninhabited. But even so, he came up heads within half a mile. A dusty pickup stopped alongside him, and the driver leaned across and said he was going to Casper, which was about halfway to both Cheyenne and Laramie, straight south on I-25. Reacher climbed in and got comfortable. The truck was a Toyota. It was raised up on its suspension and tricked out with all kinds of heavy-duty components. It looked fit for service on the backside of the moon. Certainly, it handled I-25 with no trouble at all. It droned along pretty fast. The driver was a rangy guy in work boots and off-brand jeans. "A carpenter," he said. "Busy fixing roof beams before the winter. Also a rock crawler," he said, "on the weekends. If he got weekends." Reacher asked him what a rock crawler was. Turned out to mean driving off-road vehicles over extreme boulder-strewn terrain, or along rocky rapids and dried-up mountain streams. Richard was at best a reluctant driver, so any assessment was necessarily theoretical. But he was inclined to admit it sounded fun, if pointless. Nakamura drove her Chevy back to Scorpio's block, but on a hunch, he stopped short of the laundromat and parked outside the convenience store instead. She went in and looked around. An inventory check. She saw all kinds of canned and packaged foods and coolers full of soda and juice and beer in bottles and rolls of paper towels and potato chips and candy and a deli counter and behind the register a wall of small stuff, including over-the-counter medications and vitamin pills and batteries and phone chargers and phones. She saw no-contract cell phones in plastic bubble packs, lots of them, in two rows on two pegs left and right, next to a faded sign saying pregnant women shouldn't drink too much. She pointed and asked, "Did Arthur Scorpio just buy one of those?" The counterman said, "Ah, Jesus. No big deal if he did. You're not in trouble. Information is all I need." The counterman said, "Yes, he bought one and some painkillers." "Which one?" "Which painkiller?" "Which phone? Left peg or right peg?" The counterman thought about it. He pointed. "Right peg," he said. "More convenient for me. Give me the next two." The guy took down two more bubble packs, and Nakamura handed over her credit card. When she was back in her car, she called her friend in computer crimes.
she said. Scorpio bought a burner in the convenience store. I got the next two off the rack. I'm going to bring them to you. I need you to figure out if the numbers run in some kind of predictable sequence. If they do, maybe we can put Scorpio back on the radar.
I'll try my best, her friend said.
Terry Bramall let himself into his motel room and hung his suit coat in the closet. He took his phone from his briefcase and set about answering his messages. The first was from some guy he had never heard of named Reacher. We waited in line together last night for sandwiches, and we were briefly in the breakfast place at the same time this morning. And then something to do with Arthur Scorpio and stolen property. He hit delete, because he was done with Scorpio. The second message was from his client, Mrs. McKenzie, anxious about progress, understandably.
I would like to hear either way, so please call me back as soon as you can.
He didn't. He didn't like talking on the phone, especially with anxious clients. So he texted back instead, slowly and methodically, using only his right forefinger. Dear Mrs. McKenzie, progress remains very satisfactory, and I hope to have definitive news very soon. Best wishes, T. Bramall. He pressed send. In Casper, Reacher had a choice. He could stick with I-25 and head south and east to Cheyenne, whereupon Laramie would be a short hop west again on I-80, or he could go direct on a state road. Two fast sides of a triangle versus one slow side. The hitchhiker's eternal dilemma. He chose the state road. He was sick of the highway. And he had plenty of time. There was no big hurry. The ring had been out of Wyoming for 6 weeks. No red-hot trail to follow. He walked west out of town, more than a mile, until the commercial lots left and right petered out into high desert scrub. 100 yards later, he found a head-high sign that said, Laramie, 152 miles. He sat up next to it. He felt it told the story. He watched the horizon for oncoming traffic. There wasn't much. Scorpio gave his sentries $20 and a bottle of Tylenol each, and then sent them home. They went out the front, and he went in the back room. He sat down at a long counter loaded with humming equipment. He tore apart the bubble pack and took out his new phone. He dialed the activation number, and then he dialed a 307 number. Wyoming. Ringtone. No answer. A voice invited him to leave a message. He said,
Billy, this is Arthur. We got some weird shit going on. Nothing real serious, just a strange piece of bad luck. Some guy showed up chasing a ring. He wasn't a cop. He knew nothing at all. He was just a random passerby, interested in the wrong thing at the wrong time. Turned out he was kind of tough to get rid of, so in the end I gave him Cy Porterfield's name, which means sooner or later he's likely to arrive in your neck of the woods. Don't mess with him. Use a deer rifle from behind a tree. I'm not kidding about that. He's like the Incredible Hulk. Don't even let him see you. But get on it, okay? He's got to go, because he's a random loose end. Easier for you to deal with out there than it would be for me here. So get it done. Then he added, Your privileges are suspended till I hear back from you. He clicked off and dropped the phone in the trash basket. Chapter 12 Reacher arrived in downtown Laramie at 6 o'clock in the evening, after 152 miles in the passenger seat of an ancient Ford Bronco, driven by a guy who made his living turning logs into sculptures with a chainsaw. He let Reacher out on the corner of 3rd Street and Grand Avenue, which the guy seemed to regard as some kind of an exact geographic center, which it might have been. But it was quiet. Everything had closed at 5 except the bars and the restaurants, and it was still early for them.
Reacher turned a full circle and got his bearings. The railroad tracks lay to the west, the university was east.